Hello, I'm Al Gravel. This is number 0504, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. And it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0504. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back to talk about the role self-deprecating humor plays in mental health. Can it sometimes be a self-defense mechanism?
Let's say that is the case. And what that does, then, it creates an ownership for yourself. It's almost like a blessing when somebody comes in and repeats it. It's like, yeah, like I haven't told everybody that. Of course I have a deficiency here. You know, I know that. So let's get on with our game. It kind of takes ownership of that situation away from somebody who may try to use it against you. So it is a healthy way to use it, even if that's part of the reason why.
Comedian Mark Saratella, on his early days 20 years ago when he first started doing stand-up.
I started the Comedy Store in La Jolla, which is northern San Diego, essentially. Started on their open mic night, which is Sundays. Back then, you had to bring four people, and eight people came to my first show. No one came to my second, so I had to buy four tickets myself, and then I just kept going back, almost like AA.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter goes to the old ball game with a biography of the Sultan of Swat himself, Babe Ruth, called The Big Fella. So buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jack, because I don't care if I ever get back, but I will, very soon, on the Stuff File program. Play ball!
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0504 was broadcaster and voice actor Al Gravel. He can be found on the web and through RPM Communications and at Da Vinci Talent. Al is somebody I worked with for many years in my old job at the radio station. And I thank you very much, Al, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show a bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A Taiwanese woman suffering from a swollen eye went to a hospital where doctors found four minuscule bees living under her eyelid. Hung Chi Ting, the head of the ophthalmology department at Taiwan's Fujian University Hospital, said he noticed what looked like insect legs under the woman's left eyelid and used a microscope to discover she had sweat bees living next to her eye. The woman, identified by the surname He, said she thinks the insects blew into her eye while visiting a relative's grave. Sweat bees are known to nest near graves and fallen trees. Hung said the woman was found to be suffering from the bacterial skin infection cellulitis and severe corneal erosion. Doctors said the insects were still alive and apparently survived by feeding on the woman's tears. Well, I guess cellulitis and a corneal erosion isn't the worst thing that you can get if you had bees under your eyelid. You could get, you know, hives. Oh, buzz off. That was funny. The Carter County, Tennessee Sheriff's Department had some strong leads in the death of 75-year-old Edith Betty Ralph on April the 6th, but none stronger than the behavior of her 51-year-old son, John Christopher Ralph, who had been living with her and had repeatedly complained to friends and family that she was driving him crazy. The night of Mrs. Ralph's murder, John asked co-workers to take pictures of him at work, saying that if anything happened to his mother, he would need an alibi. Edith was found deceased due to severe head trauma and several gunshot wounds. John was stopped at Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport, ready to board a flight for Amsterdam. He was held on a $1 million bond. Okay, here's the part I don't get. John's a 51-year-old man and a full-fledged adult. They caught him trying to leave the country. Couldn't he just run off to Amsterdam on his own at any time without killing his mother? I mean, if he just wanted to disappear when he had a clear conscience, what exactly was stopping him? His name is John Christopher Ralph, not Norman Bates.
Mother! Oh, God! Mother! Blood! Blood!
Thank you, Bernard Herrmann. Moving right along, when you purchase a new home, you need new stuff to put in it. So it was for 59-year-old Andrew Francis Lippy of Key Haven, Florida. Lippy purchased an $8 million private island, Thompson Island, off Key West in early April, which includes a large estate previously owned by philanthropist Edward B. Knight. But on April the 6th, Lippy was charged with felony grand theft for stealing $300 worth of home goods from Kmart, including two coffee makers, 8 light bulbs, and a bed skirt. His method was clever, kinda. He bought the items, then returned their boxes with other things packed inside. For example, a basketball was in the Keurig box. Lippy denied the charges and said, basically, it has to do with a commercial dispute. It's very complicated, and I'd rather not get into it. He's scheduled to appear in court on April 18th. Well, I'm guessing around that time he'll have to get into it. Anyway, so he buys an $8 million private island and has to steal a bed skirt and light bulbs from Kmart? Seriously, this is a guy with issues. And speaking of people with issues, 37-year-old Kaz James from Salford, Greater Manchester, England, has known since he was a child that he was different from other people. I didn't ever feel like a human. I always felt like a dog that was really out of place, he said. James first started to understand his peculiarity when he gained access to the internet at 17 years old. I was known by my friends for grabbing hold of the collar of their shirt in my teeth and biting or licking them. Very canine-type behavior, James said. Today, he eats out of a dog bowl and owns 3 custom-made dog suits, one a $2,600 fur suit shipped from Canada. What he is known as is a human pup, and James is the co-founder of the Kennel Club for others who are like him. My behaviors were quite dog-like in childhood, probably from the age of 6, he said. No one ever talked about it. It was never mentioned. Well, perhaps somebody should have mentioned it. Thankfully, there's no mention in this story that I found of him licking his own genitals. And seriously, I did a search for Kennel Club, which, by the way, is spelt with 2 Ks, and after looking over a few of their sites, now I'm concerned about the effect that's going to have on my own computer algorithms. What kind of weird ads I'm going to start seeing.
How much is that doggy in the window? I do hope that doggy's for sale.
I don't think this is what Patty Page had in mind. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? The last time we had Dr. John Huber on the program, we were talking about mental health and humor. We're doing a deeper dive into that topic this time because of a study that looks at one type of humor, that type being self-deprecating humor. According to a Spanish study, it is linked to a better sense of psychological well-being. Well, let's just see what the good doctor has to say about that. Dr. John Huber is a clinical forensic psychologist. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. He joins us once again on the line from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being on the program with us once again. So when one often thinks of self-deprecating humor, we often think of it as a self-deflection mechanism for someone to put something out there about themselves before someone else does it for them. Are we now saying that's not necessarily the case?
Well, you know, let's say that is the case. And what that does, then it creates an ownership for yourself. And almost, it's almost like a blessing when somebody comes in and repeats it. It's like, yeah, like I haven't told everybody that. Of course, I have a deficiency here. You know, I know that. So let's get on with our game. It kind of takes ownership of that situation away from somebody who may try to use it against you. So it is a healthy way to use it, even if that's part of the reason why.
Are there other reasons why self-deprecating humor is linked to greater psychological well-being?
Well, one of the things you have to understand to be able to stand up in front of an audience, in front of a crowd, and put yourself down or show weakness is a good sense of ego strength and an understanding that that one deficiency doesn't make you who you are. It is a whole person that makes you who you are, and you have other strengths in other areas. So it's okay that you are not perfectly strong or perfectly perfect in all areas. You're going to have some areas that you're at fault at. So why not attack them? Why not go after them? Especially if you do have that strong sense of self and you understand that, you know, it's not what makes you special. What makes you special is your ability to cope and maneuver and work through life, regardless of your faults.
When is self-deprecating humor a veiled attempt at insulting those around you by pointing out something about yourself?
Well, if you see that other people are having the same problems you are, you know, it could be a veiled attempt, but it could be, look, I'm just like you guys. I have problems too. So it could be I'm joining the team. Unfortunately, there are people out there who don't have that sense of self and think you're talking directly to them, and everybody in the crowd knows you're talking about me, and they take things personally. And that becomes very problematic. But that tends to be with somebody who has some narcissistic issues in the first place, because we don't know everybody in the crowd. And in fact, some people may know you as a comedian and a stand-up, but not know your whole story and even understand where you're at, let alone a stranger in the crowd who may feel like you've identified them and called them out on the floor.
I'll give you an example. I mean, I always use self-deprecating humor. That's just the way I've always been.
Yes.
But I have often mentioned when people, one of my first on-air jobs was in Brockville, Ontario, which is a small community. And I'm sure you've heard, like in the United States, people talking about in their radio career, they had to go to some small market somewhere and work their way up. So for me, it was Brockville, Ontario. So when I mentioned Brockville, people ask me, well, why did you go to Brockville? And my pat answer always is, I went there to cut my salary in half and double the black population. Now you're laughing, but I did, because I was working at a radio station here in Montreal where I was not on air. I was a board op, or known as a producer back then. But I was making more than when I went to Brockville. And when I was at home, when I was here in Montreal, I was still living with my parents. So I was making more money. I moved to Brockville. I was working. I was paying rent, which is something I had never done at that point. And I was literally the only black guy in town.
Well, you know, that says a lot about Brockville and your ability to go in there and feel comfortable in that environment to change the culture, essentially, is what you did. And I think that is something you should be proud of. I mean, that I think is something that, hey, there's a lot of places in the world they need somebody like that to walk in there and show that differences can be overcome, and that, you know, we are a resilient species and we're going to go out there and make things happen.
Okay, we'll go with that theory. Yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know where the rednecks are in Canada, so.
Oh, you know, I could tell you stories about a little community called Athens, Ontario, and I don't think anybody in Athens is going to hear me say this because I don't think they've discovered electricity. I had moments of where I thought Deliverance was a documentary. Let's just leave it at that.
Oh my goodness. So,
a growth experience for you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So getting back to the study, is self-deprecating humor something that can be linked to a particular culture? I find, for instance, and again, my background from heritage speaking is West Indian, and I find that there's different types of humor from every single West Indian island. I also believe there are different types of humor right across the country, and certainly you would see that in the United States. Is there a certain type of nationalistic pride to having a certain type of humor, in this case, self-deprecating humor?
Well, there definitely can be. You know, knowing where you come from is very important in establishing that strong sense of ego, a strong sense of self. And I think it's important that kids growing up know where they come from and who their grandparents and where their history is, regardless of where they're living currently. And I think that is something that we can take pride in as an individual. It's something that, you know, it wasn't earned. It wasn't, you know, they didn't work for it. And so it's easy to attain, and it's a good starting point if you're trying to build up that sense of self. So I think it definitely can be a positive and a strength, and it can identify where you're at. I mean, you know, I think back to different people that I've known throughout my life that had an impact on me and where I'm at in my world today. And I think about how there's some people where humor was not something that you used in conversation with them, and they never used that. And it was almost like that was part of their pride. But they also found ways to be happy in life. It wasn't all about telling jokes. To them, it was doing a good job, made them happy and gave them pride. And being the best at something gave them that sense of self-respect and self-ego. And then I talked to my family and my friends who pushed me along the way and mentors who always found something to laugh at in life. And with them, I saw them deal with trials and tribulations much differently than the ones who, you know, they prided themselves in always being as best as they possibly can be. And I think both of them have advantages and both of them have weaknesses. But learning from both their styles, you know, you find what better methodology describes or helps you describe who you are in your sense of self and your search for that. And I think it can be very, very healing and very positive and move you forward if you use that sense of humor. And, you know, those people who strive for that protection, you know, that perfection, they are kind of protecting themselves. It's like there is a weakness there and a vulnerability there. Whereas the people who are okay with making fun of themselves, they find humor in human nature, in the fact that they are human, that they do have areas in their life where they're not perfect. And there is a lot of strength to have in that. You'll be able to overcome much more if you can sit back and say, hey, today wasn't my day. I'm, you know, I didn't even bat 300. So let's move on.
Do you think that self-deprecation comes from a sense of cultural, not cultural background, but social status? Or does it improve with age or a combination of both? In other words, do you have to have a certain years of behind you to appreciate self-deprecation within yourself? Or do you have to come from a certain hardship to understand self-deprecation within yourself?
Well, I think they both can happen. You know, if you come from a hardship, one of the things that does is it takes ownership of that. When you're able to laugh at it, you take ownership of it, and people can't hurt you with it anymore. If you're talking about a sense of age, that's that maturity thing. I think that can be a part of it too. What I worry about are people who poke fun at themselves and say disparaging remarks about themselves and try to use that as humor, but it's obvious that it's not something they truly see as humorous. You know, their body language does not follow through with that mentality that this is me taking ownership of it. This is me, you know, complaining about this pulp I have in my life. And regardless of your age, regardless of your cultural experience, I think that is problematic in the sense of the Robin Williams kind of mentality. You know, when he started poking fun at himself, and then it turns out that he had been diagnosed with Parkinson's and was already having some of the memory issues associated with that. And then, you know, being asked to reprise roles that turned him into a different person with his families and friends until those roles were completed. Instead of standing up and saying, you know, I can't do that, I don't need the money that bad, he just ran away from it all and destroyed himself.
Mm. Interesting topic indeed. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. I'm sure you'll be a hit in Brockville. John, I thank you very much for being on the program with us once again.
Thank you so much, Peter. It is always a pleasure, and I always learn something from you.
Dr. John Huber, Chairman for Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0504, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. In the interest of time, kindly hold your applause until the entire program is over.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to comic Mark Saratella. Plus, Stuart Nallman is along with another edition of Book Banter. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on The Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher and TuneIn, and can also be heard via Google Play and iTunes. Just click on the Google Play or iTunes button located on the website at thestufffile.com. And whichever platform you listen to the program on, please feel free to leave a review of the show on their site. It would be greatly appreciated. Well, let's get back to the stuff. 24-year-old Santana Renee Adams told police in Barboursville, West Virginia, that while she was shopping at the Huntington Mall, a man grabbed her 5-year-old daughter by the hair and tried to drag her away. The crime was thwarted when she pulled a pistol and confronted the man, who then ran away, she said. A short time later, a 54-year-old suspect was found at the mall, identified by Adams, and arrested. "I'm thankful I was prepared to protect my daughter regarding the situation that could have gone worse," she told a reporter. However, there were not only no witnesses to the supposed crime, Adams never even yelled for help, and on the other hand, security camera footage indicates the man didn't go anywhere near the girl, and Adams never pulled the gun that was found in her pocket, nor showed upset at any time. The next day, Adams told police that she might have misjudged and overreacted to the man, and maybe he was just smiling at the girl when he patted her on the head. Well, even that was a lie. The arrested man said he never interacted with Adams or her daughter in any way, and charges were dropped. But Adams has been arrested, charged with filing a false report of an emergency. Well, while she might have misjudged the situation, let's hope the judge doesn't. Okay, I think we are glossing over a very important fact here. This delusional, attention-seeking woman is walking around the mall with her small daughter, and she's packing heat. The woman has a gun in her pocket. Doesn't that pose a problem in a mall? Yeah. Anyway, after a break-in at a woman's home, authorities searched her ex-husband's home in Altoona, Wisconsin. During the search, they found 2 shotguns, a stun gun, GPS trackers with magnets attached, and what they described as a kidnapping kit, which included rope, duct tape, handcuffs, a face mask, a blindfold, and other items. They also found a written outline of a plan. Number one, first stop box, hockey bag, duct tape, handcuff, blowtorch, nails, garbage bags, my fresh clothes, the outline said. Number two, house code, shoes off, bedroom blitz, DT gag, handcuff, legs, hood, plus pillow. The plan went on, including scripts for what to say during the allegedly planned crime, plus maps of the house and the location of a nearby landfill. The ex, 39-year-old James Holm, was charged with first-degree burglary and attempted kidnapping. Well, I'm sure he's drawn up a new plan. Number one, call a lawyer. Number two, plead stupidity. Number three, prepare prison kit. Yeah. A Florida man reportedly threatened to destroy everyone by unleashing an army of turtles. Wow. Talk about a slow death. Thomas Devaney Lane was arrested in the town of Indy Atlantic, about 120 kilometers south of Orlando, after cops received multiple calls about a man who was making a scene at several businesses. The 61-year-old was going around proclaiming himself as the Saint, while allegedly threatening to unload his reptile army to destroy everyone. Lane was picked up by an officer and transported to police headquarters, where cops say he threatened dispatch and banged on the walls and glass before leaving the building. Cops later found Lane in a 7-Eleven parking lot, where he allegedly cussed out customers and called 911. While on the phone with the 911 operator, Lane reportedly said the officer, quote, needed to leave now or you will be sorry you bleeped with the Saint. According to an arrest report, Lane refused to leave his vehicle, prompting cops to remove him by force. During the extraction, Lane continued to hurl profanities and warn bystanders about the impending doom of his turtle army. Lane was later arrested and charged with disturbing the peace, resisting arrest without violence, and misusing 911. Seriously, how worried do we have to be about a turtle army? Okay, there's those guys, but really, all you have to do is just flip them over on their backs. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, after being named chief of the Milton, Ontario Fire Department back in June of 2017, Dave Pratt, who is now 51, announced back then that he was looking forward to guiding the effective and efficient allocation of fire resources in a town that had grown from 31,000 in 2001 to more than 110,000 when he was appointed. It was the allocation of fire resources that got him in trouble. He's been fired after an investigation found he used his department-issued SUV to host sexual trysts, sometimes while parked at various fire stations. Pratt, who is married, advertised his availability on a dating website. His profile pic showed him in front of his SUV. His allocated SUV. Yes. He was using Milton property, Milton's vehicles, Milton's budgets to fund his dates, said one of the women involved. He liked to brag that he likes to give women the full fireman experience, said another. Wow. I thought the full fireman experience involved putting fires out. Clearly, some firefighters are always in heat. I'm sure his wife is going to hose out his bank account. And now that Pratt is out of his lofty job because of his actions, would that be considered a pratfall? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Mark Saratella is a very busy comedian. He regularly appears at the Hollywood Improv, the Comedy Store, and the Laugh Factory out in California. He's also appeared on Adam Devine's House Party on Comedy Central and done more than 20 independent films. Mark joins us on the line right now from Los Angeles via Skype. Hi, Mark.
How's it going?
Jess Tickety-Boo, thanks very much for being on the program with us. You have been a comedian for the better part of close to two decades. Was it always your goal? Was it when you first got into comedy that it was going to be a launching pad to other things like films and sitcoms and whatnot? Or was stand-up the pure art form that you enjoyed the most?
My very first goal was just getting through the set and somehow getting to see the red light and not walking off stage without forgetting my act. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it definitely... Anyone who steps on stage wants their own show built around them.
How did you get into comedy in the first place?
I was jumped in like a gang, kind of like how you join the Bloods and the Crips. I was walking by a comedy club and the door guys came outside and assaulted me and dragged me to the stage. Now, I started the Comedy Store in La Jolla, which is northern San Diego, essentially. Started on their open mic night, which is Sundays. Back then, you had to bring four people, and... eight people came to my first show. No one came to my second, so I had to buy four tickets myself and then basically just kept going back, almost like AA.
Wow. So you were determined, like so many people are in this field, you were determined to be successful.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I know you've also done is you've had an opportunity to entertain the troops.
Yeah, totally. I've made most of my time entertaining the Kazakhstani troops. No, U.S. troops.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been to 35 countries. I've been all over Europe, Asia, the Mediterranean. And those are definitely the best times of my life, I would say, because you're getting paid well. It's considered charity work, so it's tax-free. And the troops themselves are just really great. They're a really appreciative audience. And one thing about the U.S. military troops, too, they like all kinds of comedy. They like alternative comedy, mainstream comedy, urban comedy. They like impressions. They just like... They're a really underrated audience.
What was it like when you first went abroad and you were entertaining the troops? Did it feel different than the usual show that you've done in the United States? Did the audience react differently? What was that like?
The audience reacted a lot better than I thought they would because, you know, I didn't grow up in a military family. And so everything I thought about the military was actually the complete opposite. They were friendlier than I thought they'd be. They were much more receptive than I thought they'd be. And as odd as it sounds, like you think of military people, you think of them being like kind of closed-minded. They were like more open-minded than I thought they'd be. Also, with the military shows, it's kind of like a college gig in that, you know, they don't have a comedy club on base. So they kind of make the comedy show happen anywhere. The rec rooms, the cafeterias, some shows are outside on the sand. So that's one thing that, too, that you have to prepare for is like, you know, just a show that just kind of pops up anywhere.
Now, when you're... entertaining the troops, do you ever feel that you yourself might be in danger considering where you are?
Yeah, no. Oh, God, where's the most dangerous place? Yeah, you're smuggled in some places. Like, we did a show one year in Lebanon on Christmas Eve. And so it took us 36 hours to get there. And then they smuggle you to the embassy in an unmarked van. And then all of a sudden, you know, in Lebanon, when they blew up that building in 1980, I believe, that building they left up as like a hallmark to the people that died there. So you're at the embassy and then the ocean is in front of you. But in between, you know, where you're staying in the ocean is the hollowed out building where so many members of the Navy and Marines died.
Wow.
So that one was kind of dangerous, too, because people are coming up to the unmarked vans on motorcycles and they're peering inside to see who's inside, who's in there.
Wow.
But I've been in other locations, like the U.S. military were really everywhere. I've been in other locations where the public does not know that we even have a military base there. So our troops are there in plain clothes. And then you're there in plain clothes, obviously. And then, you know, you're not supposed to tell the public why you're there. And so, there's a little bit of danger, but that's always fun.
Wow. Are you giving away state secrets just by telling us that right now?
No. I'm not going to tell you where those are.
Okay. Fair enough. It almost sounds like sometimes I'm surprised they didn't, you know, smuggle you in with a bag over your head or.
Yeah, I mean, some of those places are closed. It's definitely very confusing. You could never get back there anyway. It's so confusing. And I doubt you're even allowed to enter the country without the correct paperwork.
Hmm. Okay, so let's get back to your comedy. And you have three CDs out right now, correct?
Yeah, I have three CDs, but they're kind of – I'm coming out with some new stuff, like – my website, markscomedy.com, if you click on the YouTube Link Up Top. That has my newer stuff. I do have three CDs. They're played on XM and Sirius, but I haven't put out a new CD in probably about 10 years, so it's, or, you know, it's our new album, you would call it now. So it's probably time for a new one.
So for those who don't know you, how would you describe the type of comedy that you do?
I think that I do social satire, which is pointing out things in society. I don't do that much talking about myself, although I'd like to probably this year probably get into that a little bit more. That's actually how you find yourself on your own sitcom, for lack of a better term. So, I do social satire, pointing out things I see in society.
Now, you grew up, if I'm not mistaken, in upstate New York, around the Albany area?
Yep, I'm from Albany, the home of bar fighting.
The home of bar fighting. So it's not, you know, a major metropolitan scene like New York, for instance.
Whoa, back up. It's the capital of New York State.
I know it's the capital.
No, it's not a metropolitan. People wear sweatpants to a wedding there.
Okay, so the reason why I bring that up is, you know, you do comedy in places like New York and L.A., and you just describe the type of comedy you do. Do you think that you being someone who takes in the social and cultural aspects of life and meld that into comedy works best for you because you're from some place that's a little more quiet and reserved and you can look at major metropolitan centers almost as an outsider?
Yeah, a little bit, but I think it's really just your personality. Like, I don't I like interviewing, I love doing podcasts, but I don't really think about myself that often. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of people are introspective. I'm just not, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's not that I'm like incapable of being that way, but I just like, I'd rather just think about something else.
You've been doing comedy, as you mentioned, for about 20 years now. Has it become any more difficult as we as a society become more politically correct?
No, I haven't had that problem because I think that certain comedians like can get away. Like, I feel like, I don't know if it's the sound of my voice or the look at my face, but I can pretty much say, and I've had very few audience. I've only had two complaints in 20 years, and one was during the Bush years. Some Navy wife didn't like that I was making fun of George Bush, and the other one was my fault because I showed up drunk to a by accident to a they didn't tell me till I was walking to the stage to a charity gig for a guy who was killed. They were raising money for his funeral, and that was at a comedy club. And then I was coming from the first day of football. I was a little bit buzzed. And like, should he be drunk at a thing like this? So it just no. I have not found political correctness to be a problem. I wouldn't care if it was.
What about things like doing colleges? Because that has become a bit of a lightning rod for some comics.
You're right. I've never enjoyed doing colleges. They're just so young. It's like, I don't mind young people in the audience, but I want some older people around them because it's just like, I did early on, I was breaking into colleges. I had a college agent. And I remember I was in Detroit at Wayne State at this function. And the kid had me run my entire act by him beforehand, which I found annoying. Then when I got off stage, the crowd loved it. And so what happens too is that the kids that set up shows are kind of usually the more dorky kids on campus. So like they're actually a little bit more reserved than the fellow students. So after I was done, he goes, hey man, the visual about the lobster, the girl with the lopsided breasts, I was like, eek, maybe you should have cut that out. And I looked at him, I go, what's that? And he goes, yeah. I go, didn't the crowd laugh? He goes, yeah, but don't you? And I go, look at man, we were supposed to get dinner afterwards. I canceled the dinner. I go, dude, we're not going to dinner now. He's like, what? I go, I don't really appreciate you giving me notes on my set. So it's just like, yes, I don't do colleges anymore, but I don't know if it's politically correct or they're just so young that I find it annoying. Also, a lot of times with colleges, it's like it pays $2,000, but you have to leave L.A. for 3 days. You're traveling one day. You do the show the next day. The next day you're alone. So you're alone for 3 days, and a lot of these campuses are really in the middle of nowhere. So it's like, you know, we think of like, you know, a campus being like UCLA or NYU. No, a lot of them are literally like a 3-hour drive from the tiniest airport you've ever been in. So yeah, I stopped doing colleges a while ago.
So what do you have coming up?
My calendar on my website has all my dates, but Tuesday I'm at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. For the East Coasters, I'm in New York at Gotham Comedy Club in May. That's on my website now. I believe it's May 13th. I'm at Gotham Comedy Club, and May 14th I'm at Empire State Casino in Yonkers, but those are on my site. and it's a Tuesday and a Wednesday night. And then I'm headlining the Hollywood Improv in June. I'm headlining the Irvine Improv also in June. But again, those are all available on my calendar at markscomedy.com.
And that's, again, markscomedy.com.
Yep, M-A-R-K-S, comedy.com.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mark, for being on the program with us.
Thank you, man. You're wonderful. I appreciate you.
Comedian Mark Saratella. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com to the page for this show, which is show number 0504, and you'll find links to Mark's site to find out where and when he is performing. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob Dorigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Information is power. So if you want information about what's done with one of the largest chunks of your paycheck, taxes, how do you get it? As someone who spent years sifting through government documents, I don't even know the best answer to that question. But fortunately, someone with a few billion dollars more than me wanted to know the same thing too, and he decided to do something about it. Steve Ballmer, the retired CEO of Microsoft, was helping his wife with some of her philanthropic efforts when he started thinking about what the government does with all of our money. There wasn't a single reliable source he could use to find out, so he decided to create one that the rest of us can use too. Let's be fair, creating a database that explains what the government really does with all our money is no easy task. But the nonpartisan website Ballmer developed, at a reported cost of $10 million, is one of the most useful tools I've ever seen for tracking and understanding government spending. You should check it out too. Learn more at centerforamericatv.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is with his peanuts and Cracker Jacks, Stuart Nauman.
Hey, Peter, wait, don't bother me. We're right in the middle of a rally here, so come on. I don't care if I ever get back, if you know what I mean.
How you doing, Stu?
Oh, pretty good. I mean, on this edition of Book Banter, I think here's something that you like and I like, and a lot of people do like, because the 2019 Major League Baseball season is underway.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. And you know that many fans are wondering whether the Boston Red Sox will repeat as World Series champions, and I think you hope so.
I do, although they've had a very slow start to the season so far.
Well, you know, it's been a couple of weeks since the season began.
Exactly.
Yeah, a lot could happen. Or maybe you're wondering that the $430 million man Bryce Harper will help lead the Phillies to a pennant, the first one in about a decade. But it's always important to look back at the players from another era whose accomplishments on and off the diamond helped to bring the game to what it is today. Now, one dominant figure in the history of professional baseball who certainly cannot be ignored is George Herman Ruth, a.k.a. Babe Ruth. During his 21-year career in baseball for the Boston Red Sox, New York Yankees, and the Boston Braves, Ruth and his ability with the bat brought the game up from the dead ball era to a time when hitting home runs were and still are key to a team's success in the standings. However, Ruth's exploits both on and off the diamond made him a larger-than-life figure, not only to the growing army of sports writers who filled the press boxes of each ballpark or stadium he played at, but also in the eyes of millions of youthful fans who looked up to the Babe and wanted to duplicate his remarkable home run hitting feats. Now, veteran writer and author Jane Levy understands what makes a pro baseball player a legend and an idol, which she proved to great success with best-selling biographies of Hall of Famers Sandy Koufax and Mickey Mantle. And now she gives the Bambino his biographical due with her latest book, The Big Fella. But this is not your average chronological biography of Babe Ruth. Levy wisely decided to focus on how Ruth's career became the catalyst to how he watched, understand, and appreciate the game of baseball for the more than 100 years since Ruth made his Major League debut. Now, the premise of the book is the 3-week barnstorming tour that Ruth and fellow Yankee Lou Gehrig embarked upon across the U.S. in the fall of 1927. Don't forget, this was a great year for Ruth. I mean, he established the single-season home run record, 60 home runs, and then him and his New York Yankees, the Murderers Row, basically made mincemeat of the Pittsburgh Pirates at that year's World Series, and they're practically known as the greatest team of all time. So it was a good year to be Babe Ruth. Now, each chapter in the book is represented by every stop during the tour, which not only brought a taste of Major League Baseball to cities and towns that have never experienced it before, but it somehow introduced or strengthened the new ways that would forever change the game. Now, this includes the introduction of the sports agent, thanks to the work of Christy Walsh, The world of celebrity product endorsements, like the battle between the Babe Ruth Candy Company and the Curtis Candy Company, which made the Baby Ruth Candy Bar, because people were mistakenly saying that it was named after Babe Ruth. The first emphasis on the science and logistics of hitting, and the beginnings of the professional sports player as media star. But perhaps the saddest part of the book deals with Ruth's later years from his retirement as a player in 1935 until his death from cancer in 1948. Now, ironically, that sense of indifference led to the establishment of another pro sports tradition, which was the retirement of one sports jersey number. And Ruth got the first of such an honor at Yankee Stadium in June of 1948, in which he made his final appearance at the house at Ruth Bill just 2 months before his death. Now, The Big Fellow, I think, is a baseball biography that is as sweeping as a typical Babe Ruth homer. The reader gets a portrait of a larger-than-life sports figure who was filled with natural talent and personal complexities. And through the story of Babe Ruth's abilities as a ball player and as a celebrity to millions, we learn how he paved the way to how professional athletes today are perceived and recognized as inspirational and controversial figures.
And my being a baseball traditionalist, it also proves a point when you talk about Babe Ruth, because I'm someone who hates the designated hitter rule in the American League. And, of course, Babe Ruth started off as a pitcher.
That's right.
Which proves that pitchers, if they work at it, can hit.
Oh, yes. And also, he was pretty mighty as an outfielder. I think he was a right fielder as well. So he had the talent. And even, later in his career, he once in a while, did a few appearances on the mound and still had that pitching prowess, even later in his career.
Yep. Get rid of the DH. That's all I have to say. But that's a conversation for another day. This week's book is entitled?
It's called The Big Fella. It's by Jane Levy. It's published by Harper, and it's $39.99.
And in following in this genre, what else do you recommend, sir?
Well, I do recommend Jane Levy's other baseball biographies that I mentioned before, the ones about Sandy Koufax and Mickey Mantle. I do highly recommend them. And also, I think you should, as a companion read, but regarding Babe Ruth, read the first serious biography of Ruth called Babe, The Legend Comes to Life by Robert W. Creamer, who was a writer for Sports Illustrated and was published in 1974.
Excellent, excellent. So again, this week's book is entitled?
The Big Fella by Jane Levy. It's published by Harper, and it's $39.99.
And should people want to find you, I'm sure you're not still sitting at Jerry Park with a forlorn look on your face. Where can people find you if they want to?
Well, they're not going to find me in caught in the vines of Wrigley Field, but they'll find me in the pages of not the Sporting News, but the Montreal Times. It's in print every Saturday or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
I'm going to add another book, by the way, to that selection. Nice Guys Finish Last.
Oh, yes. Leo DeRocher's autobiography.
Leo DeRocher and The Umpire Strikes Back.
Yes, the late, great Ron Luciano.
Absolutely. There's so many great baseball books out there, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could build a whole library just with baseball books. I mean, someone should even do a baseball bookstore, for that matter.
You know what they can call it?
What?
Extra Innings.
Hey, I think you got something there. Something to think about when I decide to retire, if I ever want to go into business for myself.
There you go. Thank you very much, Stu.
Oh, you're welcome, Peter. And I think I'll go back to the stands and watch some more baseball action.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming up in just a matter of moments, but I've got a few more Stuff File news stories that I'd like to share with you. And since Stuart and I were just talking about books, let me take a moment to plug mine. That's Great Conversations, my interviews with two men on the moon and a galaxy of stars. It's still out there. It's still available. You can still get it. You can buy many copies and share with your family and friends. Like the title says, within the pages, you'll find some of my celebrity interviews and encounters with people like Oscar winners, Carl Malden and Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, or Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and two guys who left their footprints on the moon. And that's just some of the interviews inside the book. So check it out. It's available at Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. And you'll find it in all forms, hardcover, softcover, and for your Kindle or any other e-reader that you might have. You'll find the links for the book at our website at TheStuffFile.com. So buy the book. What are you waiting for? Well, let's get back to the stuff here. Police say a couple made laxative lace cookies for striking school employees because they were tired of the noise from the picket line near their home. Authorities in eastern Ohio say none of the striking workers ate the sugar cookies, but the couple was charged with contaminating the treats. Police say the pair complained on Facebook about drivers honking in support of the striking bus drivers, cooks, and custodians. Investigators say they also made a video showing the laxative pills being mixed into the cookie batter. The strike in the Claymont School District in Tuscarawas County is in its third week. Authorities say Bo Cousins and Rachel Sharrock appeared in court to face several charges. Now, what I'd like to know is, why would you make a video showing the laxative pills being mixed in the cookie batter? I mean, thanks to their video, I guess their court case is good to go because they tried to make the picketers, you know, good to go. It's a crappy way to treat people, really. Meanwhile, a 55-year-old Fairview Township, Pennsylvania man is facing an assault charge after police said he attacked an employee at a Giant food store. Bradley A. Bauer is charged with one count of simple assault in the incident, which occurred on February 2nd. Police say Bauer attacked a cashier after he was upset with the way his groceries were being bagged. Bauer later told police the cashier put canned goods in the same grocery bag as the chips Bauer and his wife were purchasing, and the chips were smashed. Bauer said he asked the cashier to stop bagging his groceries that way. As Bauer was leaving, he asked the cashier, "Do you have a problem with me? Because I have a problem with you." The cashier thought Bauer was joking and replied, "Do you?" At that point, Bauer placed his hand around the cashier's neck. The cashier told police he shoved Bauer away from him, and other employees then stepped in to separate them. Police say the cashier suffered bruising to his neck. The incident was captured on the store's surveillance system. You know, I do buy potato chips myself, and I've always said that improperly bagging the potato chips really should be punishable by death. Yeah. And finally, it's that moment, boys and girls, the one you've all been waiting for. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I'll present, the idiot of the day.
A Pennsylvania woman who wound up on a local police department's top 10 most wanted list was busted this week after she taunted cops in a Facebook post about her being on the lam. Chloe Jones implicated herself when she commented on the wanted post by the Greene County Sheriff's Office, writing, "Do you guys do pickup or delivery?" with four crying laughing emojis, police said. Jones then got into an argument with other commenters on the post and claimed that she was at a hospital in Morgantown, West Virginia. On Monday, cops in West Virginia were able to track Jones down, who was extradited to Pennsylvania. The Greene County Sheriff's Office thanked citizens of Greene County, Monongahela County, and many others for your tips that led to Jones's arrest. The Greene County Sheriff's Office then also quipped on their Facebook page, "Miss Cleo Jones and her witty comments are taking a hiatus from our Facebook comment section due to the jail not having internet for her to use." Nice. Now, why, oh why, would you taunt police on Facebook about them not being able to find you when in reality, your taunting is probably the easiest way to find you? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0504. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0504. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.